Thank you so much, Nabil. So may I begin by thanking Nabil for kindly organizing this seminar and for inviting me to deliver a presentation in such distinguished company. I've known Nabil for many years, ever since he was a student. And as Catherine was saying earlier, it's a pleasure to have him now as a colleague and to see him leading such fantastic initiatives, both in sales and beyond. So within the framework of a seminar, which is devoted to considering whether the rule of law is a unifying principle or a source of disagreement in the union legal order, I have been tasked with considering the challenges that are involved in enforcing the rule of law as a value in the union legal order. So if I may, I would like to consider three main themes in my presentation. The first one is the thorny issue debated, as you all know, for a long time, as to whether the rule of law as a value is designed to be primarily a constitutional abstract principle or a norm that could be politically, legally, and judicially enforced. And if it can be enforced, then how this enforceability fits in terms of the different mechanisms that are available in EU law and those available before the Court of Justice of the EU. The second theme is an examination of the case law of the Court of Justice of the European Union that shows, as some of the previous speakers, Laura Baker and Catherine also alluded to it, shows an evolution of the rule of law from what seemed to be a symbolic value to what I would describe as a process of judicial amplification of the rule of law value through other primary provisions of EU law, and to the latest step, which is represented in the pending proceedings against Hungary, which have been brought by the Commission, which raises the question of the self-standing force of Article 2 or the values in Article 2 in infringement proceedings. This is the pending Commission versus Hungary that concerns Hungarian legislation, arguably for the protection of minors, but which severely discriminates people on the basis of their sexual orientation and gender identity. And the third theme that I would like to pursue is that if the rule of law value can be judicially enforced, are there some boundaries that may need to be set to respect, amongst other things, the constitutional diversity of the member states, the principle of attribution of powers, which is crucial in EU law, and the legitimacy of the Court of Justice. So let us take those themes one by one. So let's take the first one, the rule of law as a value, abstract constitutional principle, or legally and judicially enforceable norm. So the starting point, we go back to something the previous speakers have referred to, is Article 2 of the Treaty on European Union that contains, as you all know, a list of values: human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, the rule of law, and human rights. So those values have been referred by the Court of Justice in the conditionality judgments as the common values on which the Union is founded. And some of the academic commentators, like Lennertz and Gutierrez Fons, refer to them as constituting the constitutional identity of the Union. And they make some very interesting links between that and the principle of autonomy in EU law. So when we began to see a backsliding of the rule of law in Eastern Europe, that prompted a focus on what mechanisms could be available for the enforcement of the rule of law value. So turning to the treaty, something that I'm sure you all know already, the obvious political mechanism is the one that is contained in Article 7 of the Treaty on European Union. And that has two stages. The first paragraph of Article 7, which allows the Council to make a determination of a clear risk of a serious breach of the Article 2 values. This is a preventive mechanism. And then the more, so to speak, nuclear option in Article 7, Paragraph 2, which allows the European Council, acting by unanimity on a proposal of at least a third of the member states and after obtaining the consent of the European Parliament, to make a determination of the existence of a serious and persistent breach of those values. Now, we all know that that option was plagued with difficulties, particularly because it's tied to the requirement of unanimity. Alongside the development of judicial mechanisms for the enforcement of the rule of law, other non-judicial mechanisms were also developed. For example, the Commission's rule of law framework and the rule of law mechanism, which is a monitoring process, and also some legislative and therefore, of course, legally binding measures like the conditionality regulation, Regulation 2020-2092, which was designed to protect the Union budget from the backsliding of the rule of law, and which was unsuccessfully challenged by Hungary and Poland before the Court of Justice. However, if we look at these non-judicial mechanisms, the Commission mechanisms, to a great extent, are soft law mechanisms, and the conditionality regulation is confined to quite a narrow field. It doesn't provide an open-ended pathway for judicial review based on Article 2. So that prompted great interest on the question of the judicial enforceability of the rule of law as a value in Article 2. So in parallel to those other mechanisms that I have referred to, the question of whether the rule of law could be judicially invoked began to be considered, particularly in the context of two types of avenues before the Court of Justice: infringement proceedings brought by the Commission, and as we know from the previous talks, there have been many of those, and through preliminary references from courts of member states, mainly in Poland and in Hungary, that led to preliminary rulings by the court. So in this context, the initial criticism was that the rule of law, this is from the literature, the rule of law, it was, of course, a foundational value, but it was too vague a notion to be legally enforceable. However, other commentators, like Bon Borgandi, began to talk about what they described as the operationalization of the rule of law as a value. And that had two dimensions. The first one, could that value be considered as a legally binding norm? That's the first step. And if it could, then the next question is, could it be judicially enforceable? So let us look at that. Let us consider the idea of whether the value could be a legally binding norm. So the case law of the Court of Justice provides some light on this. So again, in one of the conditionality judgments, the Court of Justice told us that Article 2 of the Treaty on European Union is not merely a statement of policy, but it contains values which are given concrete expression in principles containing legal obligations for the member states. Advocate General Chapeta, who has provided a compelling opinion in the pending case against Hungary before the Court of Justice, also examines this question and gives further reasons as to why we are talking here about a legally binding norm. So she refers, for example, to the textual positioning of Article 2 in the treaty. That provision is in the normative part of the treaty, is not in the preamble. Therefore, the idea is that it has to be legally binding. Further, she also refers to the contextual and historical background to this provision. She refers to the workings of the ill-fated Constitution of Europe, which is when we had a list of these values, and she provides evidence that it was intended for those values to impose legal obligations on the member states. And the text that was used at the time of the ill-fated, as I say, Constitution of Europe has found its way, almost literally, to Article 2 of the Treaty on European Union after the Treaty of Lisbon. And then finally, a crucial point of support for the idea that we are here dealing with a legally binding norm is Article 49 of the Treaty on European Union, which is the provision that sets out the process of accession of new member states to the European Union. Because access to the European Union is a conditional on compliance with the rule of law, which implies compliance before accession. It implies promotion of the rule of law post-accession, and those two things are actually in the text of Article 49 of the Treaty on European Union, to which the Court of Justice in the Republica case went further to say that it also implied an obligation of non-regression. So we are talking about compliance before accession, promotion of the rule of law value after accession, and an obligation of non-regression. So all those arguments seem to militate in favor of the view that here we are dealing with a legally binding norm. So then we go on to the next step, which is the question of judicial enforceability of the rule of law as a value. And here is where we begin to find some arguments that may be in tension with one another. So on the one hand, we have the well-rehearsed arguments that this is too vague and abstract a value for judicial enforceability, that enforcing it judicially could lead to a threat to democratic legitimacy by allowing judges to give content to those values, and a threat to national constitutional identity, because different member states may have different perceptions of what this value may entail. On the other hand, however, we could counter argue that if we look back at the application of EU law, in many cases, the general nature of EU principles has not been an obstacle in the terms of judicial review. Further, we can also say that considering, as we have seen, that the Article 2 values are part of the constitutional identity of the Union, and that the existing political mechanisms clearly don't seem to be very effective, that maybe judicial application would be the only way to safeguard, this time, the Union constitutional identity, the internal market, and the principle of mutual trust between the member states. So let us now move on to the second theme, which, as I mentioned, I would like in doing so to look at the evolution of the case law of the Court of Justice of the European Union. So if we look at the early cases in the context of the backsliding of the rule of law, if we look back to the first cases brought against Hungary, when Hungary around 2012 began to adopt legislation that threatened the independence of the judiciary, for example, by forcing the retirement of judges at the age of 62. In those first sets of cases, which were infringement proceedings brought by the Commission, the compatibility of that national legislation with EU law was judged not on the basis of compatibility with the Article 2 values, but on the basis of their compatibility with relevant EU measures of secondary legislation, like, for example, the Equal Treatment Directive. So, for example, that legislation was found to be contrary to EU law because it contravened the principle of non-discrimination on grounds of age. However, then we have a turning point in the case law of the Court of Justice, to which Lord Baker and Catherine have referred to, and that is the Portuguese judge's case. Because in that case, it was the first time when the Court of Justice established links between the Article 2 values and two other primary provisions of EU law. Article 19.1 of the Treaty on European Union and Article 47. Article 19.1, as you all know, has a mandate on the Court of Justice to uphold the rule of law, but also on national courts to provide effective remedies in areas that are covered by EU law. And Article 47 sets out the principle of effective judicial protection. So what happened in this case is that the court said that Article 19.1 gave concrete expression to the Article 2 values, in particular the rule of law, and confirmed that the independence of the judiciary was essential to guarantee the principle of effective judicial protection. So what you have here is a kind of triangle where Article 2 is applied through other primary provisions of EU law. And that link between those three provisions, where Articles 19.1 and 47, 19.1 of the TU and 47 of the Charter, become the gateway for the application of the Article 2 values. And that kind of analysis then became the standard line of reasoning in the cases that were subsequently brought by the Commission, this time against Poland, concerning national measures that threatened the independence of the judiciary. And Catherine was talking about some of those cases earlier. So in this journey, the next step, which is the one that is currently before the court, is the question of whether Article 2 could be applied with a self-standing force before the Court of Justice. So there had been already quite a lot of debate in the academic literature about this, but this issue has now firmly been brought to the fore in the pending case against Hungary I was referring to earlier, where the European Commission has argued not only that Hungary has acted in breach of fundamental human rights, of internal market provisions, but also the Commission is arguing the violation of Article 2 of the TU in addition to the other violations of EU law. The case has not been decided by the court, but we have the benefit of a groundbreaking opinion by Advocate General Chapeta, and I would like to look a little bit more closely to her analysis of this particular point. So in considering this question of the potential self-standing application of Article 2, she begins, first of all, by considering whether the rule of law as a value in Article 2 is legally binding, and she concludes that it is for the reasons to which I referred earlier. But then she examines the question of the justiciability of that provision. And she goes through arguments for justiciability and against justiciability, the latter mainly in the light of the arguments put forward by Hungary. So in relation of arguments for justiciability, she talks about mainly three things, as I could see. First of all, she refers again to the importance of the values in Article 2 as part of the identity of the Union and as values that create legal obligations, as we have discussed earlier. Then she ties that to the nature of infringement proceedings, which is essentially to find that a member state has failed to fulfill a treaty obligation. And then she also adds another argument, which is very valid, which is that in EU law, whenever the Court of Justice doesn't have jurisdiction, that has to be expressly excluded. Like, for example, with the Common Foreign and Security Policy. And there is no suggestion whatsoever that the jurisdiction of the Court of Justice is excluded in relation to Article 2. Then she goes on to look at the arguments against justiciability, mainly on the basis of the arguments put forward by Hungary. So Hungary had argued in the case that Article 7 of the TU, to which I referred earlier, is an exclusive mechanism of enforcement when there is a violation of the rule of law. And she rightly points out that there is no evidence in the treaty that this is the case, that that's an exclusive mechanism. In relation to the argument that the values in Article 2 are too open and abstract, she counters that all the principles of EU law are quite open, and yet they have been used in the context of judicial review. And finally, she tackles the argument that giving a self-standing force to Article 2 would be a threat to national constitutional identity. She accepts that a constitutional dialogue is necessary for this, but she also points out very interestingly that the values in Article 2 also set out certain red lines that once they are crossed, because they question the constitutional model of the European Union, may require such a self-standing application. So let's look at that in a bit more detail. So if, as I mentioned earlier, Article 2 or the values in Article 2 have been, in the Court of Justice case law, applied through other primary treaty provisions, why do we need a self-standing application of the values in Article 2 or the rule of law? And her argument is that the purpose in finding a self-standing breach of Article 2 is to identify that by adopting certain legislation, a member state has crossed certain red lines enshrined in that provision. The question is, what are those red lines? And here, as far as I could see, there is a difference between the approach of the Commission and some of the member states intervening and the Advocate General, because the Commission and the member states seem to suggest that the criterion to trigger the self-standing application of Article 2 is the fact that the infringements by the member state are very serious and systemic. Whereas for the Advocate General, the criterion seems to be that because the root cause of those infringements is the negation of the values in Article 2, the grave deviation from those values, then those infringements become serious and systemic. So it's a slightly different take on what is meant by crossing those red lines. So basically, looking at all this, it would seem to me that in the process of judicial amplification of Article 2 through other treaty provisions, the Article 2 values were channeled through the other primary provisions in EU law. Whereas here, it seems to me that what is being suggested is that Article 2 provides actually a leading threat, which is that grave deviation from the EU constitutional values that then determines the seriousness of the infringements and justifies the application of the self-standing application of Article 2. So when she applies that to the facts, she's saying that here, looking at the Hungarian legislation, the negation of equality for LGBT people is the root cause of all the other infringements of EU law. That is, as I understand, the position. So let's look at the third theme. So if we accept the judicial application of the values in Article 2, are there any boundaries to be set to this judicial enforceability of the rule of law as a value? So again, here, we need to distinguish between what I've called here indirect and direct application. So indirect application, which is what I was talking about earlier, the enforceability of the rule of law value in Article 2 through other treaty provisions. I think if we apply Article 2 in that way, then the process has inherent limitations because it's done through other provisions. But what about applying the value as a self-standing provision? So here there are concerns which have been expressed already in the academic literature. So for example, are we trying to develop a quasi-federal standard of review? What about the clash with the pluralism in the member states? And what about questions on the legitimacy of the court giving meaning to or giving content to this value? So what could be the potential approaches? So from what I could see, I think there are three. So the first one, which has been suggested by some commentators like Kayser, which would be a further development of the principle of non-regression. And she sees that as an advantage because by doing that, we wouldn't be setting specific legal standards, but just developing the principle of non-regression. But of course, the counter argument is what is the reference point and when do we understand the regression as being sufficiently serious? The second possibility is that, which is the position of the Commission, I think, and the member states, is that the self-standing application of Article 2 would only be possible where there are very serious and systemic infringements of the rule of law as a value. And the third, which is what the Advocate General is suggesting in this case, is that you could have a self-standing application of Article 2 where the root cause of the infringements is the negation of the Article 2 values, a deviation that is not internal to a member state, but which affects the very functioning of the Union legal order. So I'll just finish with a few concluding remarks, because like Nabil, I'm not trying to put forward a thesis here, but just examining the themes that arise in all this. So I would say from everything that I've tried to put across is that it's very clear that there are difficulties in terms of the use of political and non-judicial mechanisms for enforcing the rule of law. And what we see is an incremental journey of judicial amplification of the rule of law as a value in EU law through the work of the Court of Justice, with the last step of that journey being the question of the potential self-standing value of Article 2. So for me, when I was looking at all this, one thing that I try to keep in my mind is that there is a difference here, because this is not a discussion about justiciability in the very kind of demanding and high threshold that you would apply, for example, for a provision to be directly effective. We are not talking about that. We are talking about the invocation of the value in the context of infringement proceedings. And for me, that is crucial because the immediate impact of looking at it that way is that this analysis is tied to the complexion of infringement proceedings. Infringement proceedings are not there to tell a member state what to do, but to say that a member state has acted in breach of EU law. And I think that's an important difference because it does not dictate positive legal standards, but determines this crossing of red lines by a member state. So when I was discussing some of this with Nabil, he had actually a very good point that he made, and it's his point, not mine. But he told me that he could see some parallelisms between all this and certain provisions that we find in other legal instruments that protect against abuse of rights, and this idea of the red light, like for example, Article 17 of the European Convention or Article 54 of the Charter of Fundamental Human Rights. So just finally, I just wanted to leave you with a quote from the opinion of Advocate General Chapeta in the pending case, where she says, "The Court of Justice is a constitutional court, and basic constitutional principles are often at the same time political and legal, inasmuch as Article 2 expresses the choice for a constitutional democracy which respects human rights, the Court of Justice's defense of those values is not its political choice, but its constitutional task. Thank you very much.